and welcome to the Brookwood and Avalon Life of the Mind podcast. I'm Sherry Walsh, assistant head of Brookwood, and I'm here today with podcast regular David Bowes, who's head of the theology department at Brookwood. Hi, David.
Hello, Sherry. Good to be back.
Excellent to have you. Today, we're here to talk about a book called The Shattering of Loneliness on Christian Remembrance by Eric Varden. Do you want to do a little bit of background on Varden?
Sure. Yeah. So Bishop Varden is the Bishop of Trondheim, Norway. Before he was named Bishop by Pope Francis, he was the Abbot of Mount St. Bernard Abbey in Leicestershire, in England. And so he's a Trappist monk. And before that, he was a fellow of St. John's College in Cambridge. Yeah. So quite an interesting life. He tells his moment where he decided to enter the monastery in one of his other books.
Oh.
It's pretty moving.
Huh. Yeah. So I know that he's Norwegian by birth and has an English education. So that sort of sets up who he is and where he's coming from. And I received this book as a present from Mrs. Bostick. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you came across Eric Varden.
So a friend of mine and I had been talking, he teaches theology down in Southern Maryland, about how we, like, reaching our students and presenting the faith in a way that could be received by them. Hmm. And he sent me two chapters from this book.
Oh, wow.
I read one of them and immediately bought the book.
So it was he sent them to you thinking that you might be able to use them in class as readings?
Yes. Yeah. So we both used them and we both got pretty good responses from our students on the texts. Mm-hmm. He's also how I came across McKean as well.
Ah, okay. So, yeah.
Which he heard about from this book. Mm-hmm.
So David's referring to Andre McKean, the novelist. I actually knew his novel, Dreams of My Russian Summers, which is not mentioned in this book, but is, you know, so we'll get, I think before the end of this, we'll get to at least an introduction to McKean, since it seems to be, so if, so the book itself consists of six different remembrances.
Yeah.
And that constitutes the structure. And it begins with the question, must I have a personal experience of something to say in truth that I remember it? So I wonder how you respond to that. And then we can talk about how Varden responds to that.
Yeah. Well, I would, my guess is he would say no. Because a lot of the biblical injunctions, so it's structured off of biblical commands of memory. And so not everyone had, I guess if you mean by personal experience, like not everyone in the Bible had personal experience of like physical experience of the events that they are called to remember.
Right.
So I would say, especially thinking about how he talks about forgetfulness as the kind of willed decision not to keep truth in front of me.
Yeah.
That memory is something far deeper than how we typically use the term.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so just in a very kind of literal way, the second is remember you were a slave in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And so there's just some discussion of how much time passes and how, again, what the people are called to remember is something that the generation before them experienced. And so like in a very literal way, there's a sense of sort of moving through time. The book talks a little bit about tradition in this way, also as a way of remembering material that is not one's experience. And so as we go through, like there are different ways of contemplating this. There's sort of, there's a place too where he talks about a kind of collective anamnesis, the idea of sort of a collective memory of of an event or of kind of a body of knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah. And anamnesis is, of course, central to Christians in our understanding of especially the liturgy and what happens in our baptism and whenever we experience the sacraments is understood as a remembrance in this deeper sense of being present at the salvific events. Mm-hmm. So there's this understanding of memory as kind of entering into God's time mm-hmm. and experiencing these saving events or these events in salvation history mm-hmm. in truth, in reality, even though they might be through sign, mm-hmm. through sacramental sign.
Yeah. And he, at the end of the book, he talks about beauty as a way to get outside of time. Mm-hmm. And maybe we are going to go to Andre McKean right sooner, yeah. sooner rather than later. Yeah. But we could do that, or we could take a turn through the introduction and then, do you want to go to beauty or do you want to go to the introduction?
We can weave our way through and arrive at beauty.
Okay. So the opening story then is about Vardin's father mm-hmm. Seeing a neighbor who's a farmer without his shirt on, engaged in some agricultural task, and seeing the man's scars, which he knew had their origin in the Holocaust. And this knowledge of this from his dad sent young Eric into a spell of reading and thinking about the event, thinking about it personally, thinking about it historically, and thinking about the idea that to become a man is to assume a great burden. Mm-hmm. Then when he's older, about 16, he encounters Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, which affected him profoundly and gave him hope. And so you have on one hand the scars, on the other hand this music, the scars suggesting the world as it is, and the music suggesting hope. And Vardin says, infinite benevolence investing suffering with purpose, so that the music pushes the suffering to purpose. He talks also in that introduction about remembrance and its relationship to being part of a larger story, being part of something larger than oneself. I don't know. Do you want to add anything about the introduction?
I would just touch on that notion of suffering and purpose and like the experience of the infinite. And even when he gets to beauty, he actually picks that up in his other book, Entering the Twofold Mystery on Christian Conversion. So mm-hmm. you have On Christian Remembrance and On Christian Conversion. And he speaks about how the Christian life is this kind of experience of profound joy, mm-hmm. but also profound suffering. Mm-hmm. And the joy gives us this knowledge of purpose too, and strength that comes from our hope in Christ, and remembrance of Christ, mm-hmm. that being in contact with Christ, that can then give meaning to everything that surrounds us. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and he talks about this as well in the introduction about this experience of Christ coming alive for him. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm on page 9. Is that where you are?
Yeah.
The church became for me an inspirer of remembrance. It permitted me to read my banal, sometimes squalid life into a narrative of redemption that not only reaches back to time's beginning, but remembers forwards into eternity. To stay within that narrative's crux is to hear, sometimes with terrifying clarity, the desolate cries of mankind. To hear, too, the rasping voice of evil, and that not vaguely roundabout, but in one's heart. One can only persevere in such hearing by attending at the same time to another, discreet but ordering voice that speaks, it is accomplished.
Yeah, and I think that actually sets us up perfectly for his first admonition, which is to remember that you are dust.
Just in time for Lent.
Yeah. With the tail end of Lent as we approach the resurrection. But and this is, I think, this... What I love about Vardin is how... So for the early... The monk, I think we might not have a sense of this in modern Christianity, because our monks, for the most part in the West, are all priests as well. Hmm. But in the early church, the monastic vocation was seen as a way to intensely live your baptism.
Hmm.
And it was more about living, going to the fullest extent of what it is to be baptized, mm-hmm. more so than necessarily about the hierarchical, clerical state.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see in Vardin, is this really beautiful reflection on the monastic life that inspires us to take seriously our baptism. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're not all called to be monks, but we are all called to be Christians. And if the monk is the one who seeks to live the baptism as radically as possible, then there's something that all of us, no matter where we are, can learn from the monk. And so that remember you are dust, he brings in the importance of having a Lenten character in our life. Which another great book that talks about what Lent is all about is by Father Alexander Schmemann called Great Lent Journey to Pascha. So he's an Orthodox priest. And he talks about the importance of Lent as having an Easter focus. And how the Lenten, Vardin talks about this as well. Lent points towards Easter. And the rule is full of paschal resonance. And Lent is meaningless without the resurrection.
Right.
And Vardin, I think, is saying the purpose of the Lenten character is not to remember you are to dust and to wallow in it, but to remember that you are dust. Without God, you will only be dust.
Right.
And I loved the first chapter. So I don't know.
He says, when I remember I am dust, I also recall that I was destined to be more. Mm-hmm. So he talks about, he talks about etymology, which makes me happy.
Yep.
having to do with dust and earth and humility and those kinds of ideas. But then talks about, dust, also destined to be more. And then he takes this interesting turn. I don't know, do you want to go to Origen of Alexandria? Or do you want to go straight to Stieg Degerman?
Let's talk about this line. This is probably my favorite line in the book. A human being is dust called to glory. A human being is dust called to glory. Because that's, like you said, when I remember I am dust, I also recall that I was destined to be more. Mm-hmm. And so what is this more that I'm called to glory? And then he says, to remain within that tension is a challenge. It takes time and strength of purpose to be reconciled to it. To accept that my nature is defined by a sense of incompletion so vast that it cannot be repaired within the order of creation, not by any possession, any accomplishment, any relationship, is to embrace radical poverty. And I think that notion, a human being is dust called to glory, and then what it is to have a Lenten character is to live that tension.
Yeah.
You know, and like, that for me, I think is just something worth meditating on and spending a lot of time meditating on, because it's really, this book, I would say, has actually changed my life in terms of rediscovering some aspects of Christianity, you know, and so that, especially where he goes when he talks about Stieg. Is it Stieg?
It is.
Okay. It is Stieg Degerman. Okay. I think I thought it was, just like the Top Gear car driver, the Stieg. it's just, there's something very beautiful about how, remembering you are dust. That helps you, I think, open your heart to really love other people, you know. And I think when he brings up Stieg, you kind of see that. So in terms of how he sees Stieg as a companion.
Yeah. And so this is really interesting. So Stieg Degerman, and I consider myself somebody who knows a good bit about mid-century literature, and I didn't know him. But did you know him before?
I did not. No.
Yeah, okay. And so you have, he's Swedish. He lived from 1923 to 1954, and he was considered by Vardin to be a resolute nihilist. We have him as kind of a Nordic counterpart to Sartre and Camus. This turn to include this figure in this chapter is just really interesting.
Yeah.
And I find it to be characteristic of this book too, that Vardin will be talking along about something and then there'll be some kind of associational transition to something else that brings to bear, which is really interesting. But the So he, there's a new section, and he says, you know, on 19 March 2001, while browsing in the bookshop of the Sorbonne, my eyes were caught by a slim yellow booklet. Like, okay. So there's not a lot of transition there. Mm-hmm. And then we understand, and he wrote the date in it because he knew it was important. And it's a piece by Dagerman called Our Need for Comfort is Insatiable. Mm-hmm. And so we have this idea. And the excerpt that Vardin gives us is, I lack faith and for that reason can never be a happy man. And goes on from there. And you have this person living with this kind of honesty and intensity that ultimately leads to his death. Because he doesn't have faith, right? Because yeah. he has this nihilism that he lives with intensity, and then that plays out as it does. So the it's interesting too. We take a turn. I spontaneously read Dagerman's text on comfort from 1952 in light of a reportage account by Vasily Grossman, composed 8 years earlier, The Hell of Treblinka. And so you have the kind of connection to the Holocaust that haunts a lot of this book, actually.
Yeah.
The way in which the people in the Grossman piece are asked to, and this is journalism, mm-hmm. the way that the people are pressed into service, destroying evidence of the killing in Treblinka, you have in sort of juxtaposition with that, Dagerman standing for a kind of tragic nihilism, you know, colored by genuine philanthropy, mm-hmm. That you get on the when we get back to Dagerman. In a society orphaned of transcendence, utilitarianism seems to many the only route to take. And you get from Dagerman, when I last read Steppenwolf, it struck me that I find in him a kindred spirit. I do not necessarily mean those who take their lives, but those who keep death close at hand, just in case, to have someone to talk to hope in. And then he ends this little excerpt, if only we had a light to hide within.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you want to respond to that?
It makes me want to read more of Dagerman.
Yeah.
Like I actually looked up the book, and it's not in English. And mm-hmm. so I, of course, being a typical American student of the early 21st century, cannot read French or Swedish. But I hope to get my hands on some of his stuff.
Yeah.
Because it does seem to me to be, like, and I think that's the brilliance of Vardin, is he's pointing us to, there is, and he talks about this in the last chapter, the longing mm-hmm. of the human heart, this kind of, and he mentions this, where is it, oh, do I have it underlined, I hope I do, yes, I walk this earth as yearning incarnate, I am at home yet a stranger, homesick for a homeland I recall but have not seen.
Yeah.
And just, oh my goodness. And I think, like, Dagerman, like, you really see this man who is really yearning mm-hmm. to have that light or that experience
yeah.
of knowing why he has this thirst for
right.
not just comfort, but really, like, for the love of God.
Right.
And it kind of points to, like, yeah, you can be cynical, you can kind of, you know, turn him into this one-dimensional character, but if you really are honest with Dagerman, there's a kindred spirit there, mm-hmm. longing for wholeness.
Right, the intensity of it, yeah. the longing,
yeah.
is the piece of it that's that Vardin identifies with, mm-hmm. and also, I mean, again, in the last chapter, mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it's that that longing to. I guess we just have to go there, and then we can go other places
go
too. But the idea of that longing. Is so powerful, and he talks a little bit about how longing can sort of turn into a kind of comfort with itself, that the longing itself can become pleasurable, and that's a danger,
yeah.
and that there are also ways to kind of misuse or misplace the longing. But there's a growing sense of that there's a kind of, I mean, I don't know, that you get these kind of proto, that's maybe not fair to say proto-Christian,
yeah.
But you get these writers who have the longing, who love the beauty,
mm-hmm.
And who are yearning for this transcendence that they can't quite name or arrive at. And that these writers are interesting to Vardin as sort of people along the way, sort of sympathetic figures along the way. And then at the end, of course, he urges the reader and others to, of course, do what they can to find fulfillment in Christ, to take it the rest of the way. And he talks a little bit about the sweet torpor that precedes full awakening and how that's a kind of danger. But then ultimately, he says it's possible to recognize the logic, and their logic is logos, mm-hmm. of longing while withholding a logical response. And, you know, to preserve ourselves from such an enticing but ultimately dissatisfying vagueness of mind, we can recall that to take note is one aspect of awareness. So there's a lot about awareness,
mm-hmm.
Here at the end, beware lest you forget the Lord. And so beware is resonating to something about protection, and then also something about awareness,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about how that operates.
Yeah, I did love like how he broke down the etymology of beware, and how, you know, the importance of there's a conscientious choice to be made of keeping God in mind. This is just a very powerful line from the sixth chapter. The fact remains, we often live as if God did not exist, and that yet Christian life is the practice of Memoria Dei, the remembrance of God. It's like keep the face of Christ always before us,
mm-hmm.
and the question becomes like, yeah, this beware lest you forget the Lord. Pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Be attentive to everything going on in your life. And recognize that longing is from God. I think it's
yeah.
like a very powerful thing. That longing is from God. And those experiences of beauty. I restructured a lot of the senior class, and this text, McKean, and then Pieper's Happiness and Concept.
Oh, that's
yeah,
great. Okay.
Like all
yeah.
kind of the centers, the kind of like the anchors. Well, Happiness and Contemplation would be the anchor, and then
yeah.
everything else kind of flows out of that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, because that's what we see. And the reason why I love McKean is because I have not encountered a writer who describes a moment of contemplation like he does. Now that might just be because I haven't read a lot of people who describe contemplation, but like I was reading him this summer with Happiness and Contemplation,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like, wow,
mm-hmm.
he is putting into story
mm-hmm.
what Pieper is describing philosophically.
So how does that work? I mean, so can you give an example? I mean, you can talk about McKean for a second, I think.
Well, I think it's just like these moments of beauty, like that
okay.
Vardin talks about where you there's an ecstatic in the sense of coming out of oneself
yeah.
experience, like where there's a sense in which, and I ask my students to just like to think about this, the seniors to reflect on this, where you've had a moment where in a sense, like time really has stopped. There's just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's
did
just
they talk about Anna Karenina at that point? Cause we,
well,
we talk about
before.
Flow. Yeah.
This,
okay.
This was, but I meant like in their lives, like
yeah,
how
yeah,
you
yeah.
had a moment. Where,
no. I mean like,
yeah.
but that's sort of the pivot to going back out. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah. And McKean describes, and also like where, because of one object,
mm-hmm.
where you see it, something as
yeah.
it truly is, all of a sudden, all of reality is open to you.
Yeah.
And,
sorry, I'm distracted. The students, my students, your students,
yeah, yeah.
our students, are now writing these final Anna Karenina papers,
okay.
in which some of them are talking about flow.
Okay.
And as I think about it, several of them are talking about it as in terms of contemplation
oh.
in a way that kind of goes past what we did in class.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Look at that. Things are happening.
Wow.
At
well, I mean, you worry that they just
yeah.
sort of put it in a file folder
yeah.
in their heads and,
right.
and don't cross-reference, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, that is something, like several of them have deepened that idea, because we looked at the video from the mm-hmm. psychologist who came up with the idea mm-hmm. of flow and in his terms as like a psychological idea. And then talked about it and talked about when it occurs in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we sort of touched on kind of theological resonances, but yeah. not clearly, wow. not to the fullest. Wow. So that's interesting.
Yeah,
huh?
That's awesome.
It's a nice little discovery.
Yeah. But yeah, and I think like that's, you know, when he sees McKean as like, he makes clear he doesn't want to like make McKean into like this hidden Christian.
Right.
But I do see in McKean this man who's had these experiences, or at least can describe these experiences of contemplation, of kind of being in connection with the infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate that McKean does not yet clearly see. Hopefully he will see, because he has a line in one of the stories where he's like, the problem is looking for a paradise that endures.
Mm.
You know, and he talks about, no, just live these moments.
Yeah.
But he also talks about remembrance, yeah. interestingly.
Yeah. I mean, so you get somebody like Virginia Woolf,
mm-hmm.
Who I think does, a, you know, who handles this idea of moments of being, right? Sort of mm-hmm. these moments that open out, that take you outside of time. Mm-hmm. But of course, too, like she's not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real sort of temporal limitation to, I mean, I think she gets, that's maybe not fair. I think she does get outside of time mm-hmm. in these moments of being, but there's kind of a limit to it. It stays in more of a psychological realm maybe reaches further than that, but doesn't make it to a place that's more spiritual, even really.
Mm.
So you get McKean looking for those moments.
Yeah.
You're talking about them in terms of contemplation.
Yeah.
And certainly we get that a little bit in this chapter also when Vardhan talks about Rilke. And talking about sort of the call of the problem of the young brother and the call of the senses and the sort of like yearning on one hand, and then later he talks about the difference between longing and desire. That mm-hmm. desire is about pleasure, whereas longing I have it.
I have it here. Longing refers to yearning for a lost or distant thing.
There we go.
A thing known and treasured, but now out of reach.
Yeah.
And so he's using Athanasius's De Incarnatione, on the incarnation of the Word, as kind of the central piece for the meditation. So
uh-huh.
Athanasius distinguishes between desire and longing. And so that's where we have desire from hedone, which sounds like hedonism, because that's where that comes from. And then longing, or pothos.
Yeah.
Pothos. Which I think, like, yeah, and sometimes we confuse these in ourselves, and living that, again, the tension
mm-hmm.
of dust made for glory involves sorting through all these things.
Yeah. But I mean, like, literature mm-hmm. since 1914, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has been all about that, right? Longing mm-hmm. for a past that is not recoverable. And then of course you see it manifesting in lots of different ways. I mean,
yeah.
you can get it all over. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's thinking about in the last chapter, Vardhan kind of opens it out to our world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like that's very much what people are concerned about. I mean, that there's a sense of loss.
Right. But yeah, I mean, you can't not have the sense of longing. But then, if you don't know what you're longing for,
right?
What then? And I think that what I like about Vardhan is he's kind of saying, like, you know, this experience of longing that people have is a way to, one, the experience of longing that we have is a way to call to mind who we are made for, and to be aware of those experiences when
mm-hmm.
We have these moments of contemplation and can begin to live more intensely and more fully and more consciously and over time simply the way of being
mm-hmm.
of kind of living in this restless restfulness,
mm-hmm.
this restful restlessness
right.
that I think the Christian finds finds himself or herself in. But right. also, it's a way to talk with others. You know, it's a way to find common ground with mm-hmm. the secular world.
Right.
You know, that this longing that we have is not something to be done away with, not something to be suppressed.
Right. Or but, numbed or yeah. covered over in some way. Yeah.
But also not something that means we can just, like, that we can figure out how to solve it.
Right.
You know, but that it points to an incompleteness in us,
mm-hmm.
that it, but also it points to the fact that we're made to be whole.
Right.
You know, and these, I think all of these various forms of remembrance that he's calling mm-hmm. us to mind is in sense of that way of finding the wholeness that we all crave.
Right. And the emphasis on the restfulness, mm-hmm. restful restlessness.
I think both end.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, sort of that idea makes me think of the Lot's Wife chapter, where there's a lot about, new word choice. There is plenty of information about the, about what it is to keep moving forward. There are lots of different ways of looking at the story of Lot's wife. Maybe we yes. should start just there. We'll start with the story of Lot's wife and then figure out sort of the different ways of interpreting it and then the different places mm-hmm. that that Vardin goes from there. Do you want to tell the story?
Yeah, sure. So Lot's wife, Lot, was Abraham's nephew who went and settled near Sodom. And when the Lord went to investigate the wickedness of Sodom, warned Lot that the city would be destroyed. And so Lot was able to escape, him and his wife and their daughters, and they were both all instructed, do not look back. And Lot's wife looks back, and she is turned to salt. And so Jesus gives this admonition to his disciples right before he sets his eyes towards Jerusalem.
Hmm.
And right after, he tells them to forgive, and also to simply do what you are to do. So it's this strange passage in Luke's gospel that Vardin is trying to make sense of.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives three possible kind of exegeses of Lot's wife. And why did she turn around? Like, why did she choose to turn around? So do you want to break down those?
Well, I mean, I think that, so there's first of all, Lot choosing the land towards Sodom,
mm-hmm. yep.
And how that in ways shows, and also I think apparently because it reminds him of Egypt, which is a sign, yes. But it indicates kind of a lack of spiritual ambition on his mm-hmm. part. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't teach his people adequately about God. And so when it's clear that that they need to go, when the angel comes to tell them to leave, they don't believe it's real. Like they don't yeah. understand it. They don't get why they should obey, because they haven't been preparing. Mm-hmm. So that I think is important. And then there are different interpretations. You have an allegorical idea that Lot represents reason and she represents the flesh, mm-hmm. because flesh is always looking back to vice. Mm-hmm. And so nostalgia for comforts can quench the flame of faith, says Vardin. So there's that idea. But you were interested in the reasons that's a reason to turn around.
Yeah.
There's also that she's turning around to her home, right? Like what yes. she knows as her yeah. home. And so like her turning and this is where my life has happened,
mm-hmm.
That there's a desire to sort of turn and look at that. And of course the lesson is that she should be looking forward.
Right.
What else do you want to do with that?
But there's also the this is on page 67 at the bottom. To remember Lot's wife is to prepare for a severance that may bring pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gives us a poem from the Russian poet
Anna Akhmatova,
who paints Lot's wife in a sympathetic light and also points to the radicalness of the gospel,
mm-hmm.
and what God calls us to. And so this, he gives the kind of, whether we regard her final glance as a failure to understand, So Lot did not do his job proclaiming
right.
the God of Israel to the people of Sodom. A function of sinful inertia. So that would be the, like, our desires have not been transformed by Christ to
right.
lift us up to God. Or as a state of being pierced by homesickness, she stands before us approachable and close.
Mm-hmm.
So that state of being pierced by homesickness, I think is, I don't know, I thought that was a really fascinating way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found this to be the case. Actually, I found all of these to be the case in my own life. Why I go back to my sins. That one, I think, there is something that when you choose to follow Christ, like there is a severance.
Sometimes
that can come.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think there's also sort of, I mean, one gets kind of, one's identity gets bound up in one's mm-hmm. sinfulness, right?
Yeah.
And so like severing from that feels like part of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a way that is important to differentiate.
Yeah. Or even just friends. So like my wife, my wife in high school, like, basically like all of her friends,
mm-hmm.
She was not super Christian. And then she started, you know, taking her faith more seriously. And it meant like there was a severance there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there was a sense in which she lost
mm-hmm.
basically her whole community.
When she was in high school.
Yeah. Cause all of her friends were interested in doing other things and she was trying to walk the faith. And yeah, there is a sense in which remembering Lot's wife kind of gives us a sympathy, to recognize, okay, we don't want to be like Lot's wife, but at the same time, we have to recognize, I think, the difficulty
right.
of the Christian life and how we have, a responsibility to others, too, to be a source of consolation so that they don't end up like Lot's wife.
Right.
You know, those of us who have seen, you know, mm-hmm. to accompany and walk with others.
Right.
To help them keep moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea too is, to resist Salinization I went on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
To do that is to move forward. Right. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. the importance of moving forward. And I mean, of course the Bible, admonishes us to do that
right.
in all over the place.
Yeah.
And so there's, so that's easily reinforced. Mm-hmm. What Vardin does though, is he turns to Tolstoy, like you do, in order to tell us about, the story, Father Sergius, mm-hmm. which is, a piece that was published posthumously, and that Tolstoy revised over and over, and sort of the story of that character, that he's a complex character. He has a hot temper. He's rigorously honest and he's kind of a perfectionist.
He's also ambitious, like super ambitious.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And so he loves this woman, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And when it turns out that she has a past with the Tsar,
who hero worships.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Then at that point, the character whose name is Katoski, he runs to a monastery. So for a bad reason, right? But the idea is that there's a good reason underneath it. And so thinking about forward momentum. And then in the story of this character, he has to sort of stop, reassess, kind of decide what the next thing is in radical ways several times before we get to the end of the story. I don't know if you want to talk more about that.
Well, I think just that the forward progress is never assured. And, you know, so it's interesting because he did join the monastery for bad reasons, but also there was a sense where, and I think this gets into like the complexity of all of our life decisions, like we might not always have the purest of motives, but that doesn't mean there isn't some pure motive.
Right. So
underneath. Yeah. yeah. Waiting to kind of mm-hmm. be rooted out, kind mm-hmm. of like up, you know, brought to life.
Right. And then if you want to talk about what's wrong with me, it has to do with, like making the right big decision,
mm-hmm.
but then having to follow through
mm.
all the time,
yeah.
every day. matter what, you know, and sort of like that. I mean, that, and that's what happens to the character, that he, that he gets, he sort of falls into a state of spiritual depression. Yeah. And again, that's the connection to Lot's wife, that, and that sort of state of spiritual lethargy, that, and so we're reminded that, you know, conversion has to be positive, an option for what's good, not against what's bad, but an option for what's good, and sort of how that works. So he's sent then, to a hermitage where again he has another encounter and you know we go on from there.
I think it's just you see the danger of acedia in the Christian life, like, and he mentions that, and we've talked about acedia on previous podcasts. But you know, and I think actually our spiritual our Lenten mission at my parish, the first talk was on acedia, and and the priest was talking about how we can be subjected to acedia, or we can fall into it without even realizing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting is,
well, is that because it feels like you're doing something good? It's just not the right thing?
Yeah.
It's just not the thing you should be doing? Or
I think it's because it slowly over time just becomes normal. Like it just becomes your kind of normal way of operating. And I was like reflecting.
Ooh, I
like,
feel called out. Okay.
Well, I was going through a period, I think, of acedia in some ways, you know, a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh, you know, and, you know, Varden helped me break out of that, you know. And so
right. I mean, I guess there's a feeling of like, it's normal. It's what people do. Yeah. And
But just, you know, like acedia in the sense of like the goods of the spiritual life have lost their joy, you know, and it becomes kind of stale.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, and that's what happens to Father Sergius, and he, and Varden, of course, is reminding us to stay faithful. But then be ready to break up again and again. To
leave again
even
and
what
again.
We thought would be our final destination, to let love be purified.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at the number of episodes. I mean, so there's the Mary episode, and then there's going to the hermitage, and then there's the woman who tries to seduce him.
That he
and,
did,
and he chops off his finger.
He chops off his finger in order to not fall. Yeah,
yes. So he, I mean, again, so doing the big heroic thing,
right.
And then time passes, and you know, so so and the woman, so the woman converts and joins a convent.
Yeah.
He doubles down and comes alive again as a result of this. Then performs
some
miracles.
Healings.
Yeah, and becomes famous. And then you can feel the grace dying down in him.
Yeah.
And then some woman shows up, and he's immediately vanquished.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this idea that like again and again, one has to be ready to double down to have a new way of seeking the right path. And so, actually, and then after that, there's more, right? The cousin, the dull cousin
Pashenka. Yeah.
And sort of the idea that there's this, and Tolstoy does this, where you have somebody who's very unassuming, who ends up being a kind of model for the somewhat pretentious or ambitious main character. But the idea, you know, Sergius ultimately, I live for men on the pretext of living for God, and she lives for God on the pretext of living for men.
Yeah.
And so he tries again. And yes, I mean, again, it may not be sufficient to depart only once.
Yeah.
So.
But what I like is also the previous chapter with St. Mary of Egypt.
Yes.
Kind of has very similar themes. And she, and maybe Tolstoy is drawing all, I mean, because Tolstoy would have been in the Byzantine liturgical tradition. He would have known Mary of Egypt very well. And, you know, you can't help but see these influences. Like Father Sergius is instructed to look at Pashenka and see kind of what Christian life is about.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, which again, is just a beautiful reminder of how we as Christians have a common union with all people. And there's something we can learn from about what it means to live a Christian life, even in unexpected places.
Yeah. I feel like you're about to take a turn into Flannery O'Connor. It's about to happen.
Oh, I wasn't.
I sense it.
You have a Flannery O'Connor reference.
No, and then, so Varden doesn't.
Yeah.
And so that's a hole in his education.
Yeah.
But maybe not. But yes. But that idea of grace appearing in unexpected ways for people who are not prepared to accept it.
Yeah.
And sort of like how that works again and again. But yeah, so in, you're right. In the previous chapter, The previous chapters, remember that you were a slave in Egypt, mm-hmm. And you have the story of Saint Mary of Egypt kind of a lesson about freedom and slavery, and what, like, we have to seek reconciliation with our past, mm-hmm. And some of those kinds of ideas. Do you want to do something with that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I love all these chapters. But what I loved about it is, so the first one, right? Remember, you are dust. Is okay. What are you from your origin as a human? But then, as Christians, right? We're all sinners. We also have to remember our sin, in the sense of to not get prideful. And he says in this chapter, to the point of remembering that we are were slaves in Egypt, is not to wallow there, but to relive our ransom, to keep thanksgiving alive, and not least, to learn to whom we should address it. Here, too, we are challenged to own where we are from. No longer our origin from dust, which is God's gift, but the origin our life has acquired through our choices, right and wrong, and through apparent chance. In light of Christ's Easter victory, even our worst memories of freedom compromised can become occasions of praise. Just that, yeah, like, I think especially nowadays where everyone's playing the victim, everyone's trying to make excuses for their choices, mm-hmm. and just this radical call of Mary of Egypt, right? Mary of Egypt does not sit around and say, make excuses. She owns her sin.
Right.
And yet...
And is it that she sins for 17 years, she suffers for 17 years?
Yeah. But it's not like a suffering, like punishment. It's more her being purified, mm-hmm. of her habits that she's acquired.
Yeah.
And her choosing to kind of live through these, and I mean, anyone who's you know, lived a life of sin can attest to this, you know, this period of purification. But, you know, and it's so we remember, mm-hmm. the grace of God, that God has redeemed us from anything in our past. And that's just, I think, Mary of Egypt is, of course, so the setting of Mary of Egypt is this monk who's really incredibly virtuous, very pious, but feels like, okay, I haven't made it. Like, I'm not perfect. I'm missing something. Mm-hmm. And then he's instructed to go, and he'll meet someone who will help him see what it is to be perfect. And he's like, okay, who's going to show me? And he sees Mary of Egypt, and there's a beautiful scene where they're both kind of arguing over who gets to bless whom, which is just amazing. And it ends with Mary.
Well, I mean, at first she seems really strange,
oh,
right?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
She's naked. He chases her. She knows his name.
Yeah.
And then they try to bless each other.
Yeah.
And I like how they reconcile that. They agree to bless God.
Yeah. Well, she blesses God, right? Mm-hmm. And then she starts telling him about her life, and he sees in her kind of what he's been missing, mm-hmm. this sense of receiving everything as a gift.
Yeah.
That,
right.
And that's kind of the whole point is, conscious of our sins, we see what we are without God.
Right.
And then we can actually recognize just how blessed we are, mm-hmm. and that God has given us grace and his love. And it's just beautiful.
Yeah. So looking at the book as a whole, as we start to think maybe about winding it up,
talked about Do This in Remembrance.
We can do that. We can go there.
That's my favorite chapter.
Well, let's do that then. I was just going to do a little reprise. We have dust first, then we, mm-hmm. have Remember That You Were a Slave in Egypt, then we have Remember Lot's Wife, then we have Do This in Memory of Me. Is, mm-hmm. that where you want to be?
Oh, yeah.
Let's do that.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Do This in Memory of Me is, of course, a reflection on the Eucharist. And what I love about it, this actually set up some really fun classes reading this one, was, mm-hmm. What I just saw as a remarkable story of what it means to love like Christ in Mighty, you can correct me.
Well, I don't know. Gertaner? Yeah.
Who was this woman in the, I believe she's French.
Yes. She's certainly a veteran of the French Resistance.
Yeah, French Resistance, who helped smuggle a lot of people out of France during Nazi occupation, but got caught, mm-hmm. and loved music and was tortured.
And she's quite young.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was, Yeah, so she was what?
She was born in 1922, and yeah. She was caught, I believe, in 1943.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, very young, whole life ahead of her, and just tortured, and couldn't play music anymore.
Yeah.
But while she was in prison, there's this line that really, really stuck with me. She assumed responsibility for her captors. Christ's commandment resonated in her as a non-negotiable moral imperative. Mm-hmm. Love your enemies. And then she says, about the doctor especially, already then, the desire to see him saved at the last was born deep inside me. Mm-hmm. It was a desire free of sentimentalism. In retrospect, it acquired a fearful lucidity. And this is from My Tea again. My way of wishing him to be saved was to wish no less to vanquish the evil I carried in me, yeah. of which I myself was an accomplice.
Yeah.
And that's what I love, because that was so powerful for me, because I think we tend to think of loving our enemies as somehow like we are in this position, like we're not loving right. our enemies for our sake.
Right.
You know? But she's getting right to the, like, her salvation yeah. is at stake.
Yeah. This is kind of, this is very similar to some lines in Eddie Hillesum, okay. about whom we talked a couple weeks ago with Father Medina. Mm-hmm. And I mean, but the idea of, I mean, certainly taking responsibility for one's captors, mm-hmm. and then also this idea that that taking responsibility, or, you know, wishing him to be saved, mm-hmm. is a wish to vanquish my own evil. Yeah. I mean, she says something really similar to that. Mm. I mean, yeah. I think that she's in ways, she's a complicated figure.
She
but
is.
The, yeah. But you but have...
she loved Matthew's gospel.
Yes.
And love your enemies is from Matthew's gospel.
Yes. Yes. So, yeah, so talk about, I mean, you go ahead and continue to tell the story.
Well, so I just, that... really hit, of course, the Our Father, right? Forgive us as we forgive. And
right.
so you see, I think just a really helpful way of seeing, like, this is what it is to love like Christ. Mm-hmm. This is what it is to be a Christian.
Yeah.
To recognize that my salvation is caught up in the other's salvation.
Like, right. And, like, I mean, this maybe isn't like a stumbling block for other people. Maybe it's just for me. But the idea that my own salvation needs to be like my priority, like and I need to take care of that, like I need to to make my efforts move in that direction, as and that, like, as a kind of orientation, and that for and that here my way of wishing him to be saved was no less a wish to vanquish the evil I carried in me. And so you can see how it's all connected, and that, like, you know, wishing him to be saved is, you know, reflects on the self, but it's also, I mean, but those things, it works the other way too, that taking care of, you know, working to vanquish the evil is connected to wishing him to be saved. So that, I mean, seems to work both ways. I found that to be really important.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And just, well, I think I like posing this question about, like, how she desires to love here, and really wrestling with it, because this is a very radical, like, what she's doing here is very radical in terms of, especially in our culture, with the glorification of the victim and to really hold on to wrongs, you know, that, but, like, what she is seeing is, like, holding on to the wrong done to her.
Yeah.
Like, and then willing, like, she says, to vanquish the evil of which I was an accomplice. Like, she's saying, like, there was a sin happening that she was committing if she did not desire his salvation, you know, and that is a powerful grace, you know, and what it really means to do this, to celebrate the Eucharist in remembrance of Christ, to really enter into Christ's Passover mystery is I think to have this wish that she has here, which is not easy, you know?
Right. Right.
But yet it begins with that desire to actually live and recognize, yeah, like, because I think there is a tendency to kind of make love not, there's the tendency to make love either purely the will or purely sentimentality. In her, we see something much more profound where there is, it's not sentimental, but it's also not anti-emotional.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's a full experience of the human, where she's recognizing her need as well as this doctors need.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And so that's, I mean, so the first thing is about the captors. The second thing is that, so much later in 1984, the doctor who had been in charge of the manner in which she was tortured.
Yeah.
She had the base of her spine was repeatedly cudgeled. That was the way that she was tortured. And it wrecked her, you know, like it ruined her health. So this person appears in 1984 to ask for forgiveness.
Yeah. And she takes his head between her hands and kissed him on the forehead.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and this, I mean, I believe I'm in the right place. I might be, oh, I'm not. So this is earlier. I had not to be nostalgic for what I had been or what I might have become. Instead, I had to love what I was and to seek what I ought to be. Mm. So there's that earlier, but then in conjunction with the person, the doctor who comes to ask for forgiveness, having seen her pardon confirmed, she remarked afterwards, one is no longer the same. And so when we understand that the doctor was, you know, was also... Yeah, I can see how that would be something that our students would appreciate, and it would give them a nice window to a kind of deeper experience of some of these ideas.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm noticing that we're hitting 55 minutes here. So is there? So we haven't talked about the counselor will call everything to mind, which has the story of Saint Seraphim. And there's, you know, there's other stuff. Is there anything that feels really important to say here on the podcast? And then we can recommend the book strongly to people.
Oh, I think I can't find it, but there is a beautiful line in The Counselor Recall Everything to Mind that really points to... No, that was a different reading that we did. Never mind. I mean, it is all wonderful. And I'll just end with how Father Seraphim greeted everyone, and then we can recommend it, which is, Christ is risen. No matter what time of year, he would always greet people with that admonition, my joy, Christ is risen. And that is what we believe, and that is what we live. And calling these things to mind, I think, helps us do that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Life of the Mind podcast from Brookwood and Avalon Schools. I'm Sherry Walsh here in the Eric Varden Shattering of Loneliness episode with David Bowes. Like how I left that open so we could have another episode about another book. Our producer is Quentin Walsh. Our theme music is by Fabian Tell. Views expressed are the participants' own.